Hello, this is Radio Free Flint. You're listening to Arthur Bush. Today's episode is with author Gregory Frenier, who's written a book about serial killer John Norman Collins. Mr. Collins operated around the University of Michigan campus in Ann Arbor in the late 1960s. He was convicted of killing a young lady and sentenced to life in prison without parole. Mr. Collins' crimes is believed to kill several other women, both in Michigan and as well as California, gripped the state of Michigan and the nation in the vastness of and the brutality of his killings. John Norman Collins gave rise to the term serial killer. Before that, we never really referred to them as serial killers. This Radio Free Flint podcast comes to you by way of anchor.fm. We also have a website which is located at www.radiofreeflint.media. That's www.radiofreeflint.media, where you can see this episode in video or follow any other podcasts that episodes that we've released. And we hope that you would do so. Also, we plan to put out a newsletter in the near future, and if you'd like to get a copy of our newsletter once a month, please go to the website and subscribe, or you can just send us an email, and we'll take care of it that way. Thanks again for joining us. Here's the episode. Okay, you're listening to Radio Free Flint. Today, my guest is Gregory Frenier, a retired professor who lives in one of the greatest weather places in the United States, San Diego, California. Welcome, Greg.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, Greg, this is your second round here with me, and you're the first author that I've invited back twice. So either that says I'm hard up for guests or you're really good. And my audience really liked your time with us when you talked to us about the Purple Gang. And so I thought I'd work on another book that you did, although it's a couple of years ago. It's a fascinating case. It's an unsolved murder, the John Norman Collins case. And I'd like to talk to you about that. You wrote a book about it.
Yeah, Terry McFilani. John Norman Collins Unmasked. And the unmasked part is that I don't feel that there was ever a good account of who he was and, you know, how he got that way. And it's actually been pretty well received. The first book that came out, I hate to give a plug for it, but it's called The Michigan Murders. And the guy who wrote that wrote it 5 years after the fact. And I wrote my book over 50 years after the fact. So I had the benefit of hindsight. But I also had the benefit of being on the campus at the time, understanding the campus culture, being in that neighborhood, which was just south of Eastern Michigan University's campus. And, you know, the students called it the student ghetto because the homes were 100
years living, old. You at one time lived in Ypsilanti at the same time that John Norman Collins lived there.
We were students at Eastern. He was a year ahead of me, but he lived a block down the street from me. And before I knew about him and any of this, you know, ugly business, I had a couple of, I don't want to call them run-ins, but encounters with him. And they were always negative. And, you know, one time he took a swing at me. Actually, he was trying to clothesline me while I was walking down the street. And I turned around real quick, you know, to get in a defensive position because I didn't want the guy to jump me from behind. I didn't know what was going on. And he just kept walking and walking and walking. I watched him walk to his home. He was renting a room in a small little boarding house. And so I knew where he lived then, but I, again, did not know what he was up to. And very few people knew what he was up to. But
what he was up to is murder.
He murdered, as far as I can discern, 7 women. And he put many more women, young women, in harm's way, asking them to get on his motorcycle or get in his car, or, you know, let's go here and there. And a lot of them just felt, I've spoken to a good many of these ladies, and they just had a kind of an uneasy feeling about him, you know, a bad vibe. But on the other hand, there were people I've spoken to that did get on the motorcycle. He didn't murder them. And you know, some would say, you know, he seemed like a nice guy, but he had no trouble getting a date. He didn't have to kill these women to have sex with them, to put it bluntly. And so it comes down, and I'm going to just jump to the chase with my opinion, and that's all it is that John Collins was a control killer. There's a term for it. I just had it and it slipped out of my mind. Power and control. And I think that appealed to him a lot. And he had many chips on his shoulder. But I think he had a big one here from a domineering mother, and he was the third child of a divorce. And, you know, I'm going to venture to say that he was the third child. He was the unwanted child. And there's background that I give in the book about his father and his mother.
Yeah, let's go back here for just a second and set the stage. This guy became famous. In fact, some people think that he gave definition to what was the term serial killer, which until the 60s, we really never had that in our lexicon in Michigan or anywhere else, did we?
No, they were called multiple murders, multiple murderer. At the time, and it wasn't until a few years later, the golden age of serial killers would be the 1970s through the 1980s, and all of the big names that we're all so familiar with, and they've had book after book and video after video on them.
Norman Collins was he roamed the streets in the late 60s.
Yes. He was before them. And I dare say that he was the prototype for Ted Bundy. If you study both of those serial killers, you'll find that Bundy was so much like Collins psychologically, socially, you know, both were ambitious. You know, there were differences, of course, but how he killed and who he killed, very similar, because they always, went for either the college-aged young woman, or in John Collins's case, he killed 2 teenagers, a 14-year-old and a person who was 16, but she had only been 16 for 20 days. So essentially, she was 15 years old. So
now Collins was a student as well, Eastern, right?
Yes, he was an English student who was trying to get his credential in elementary education. You've got the primary, the early grades, And then you've got the, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, in some cases, seventh grade. So he was going for the, you know, younger students, and he wanted to be a PE teacher and with an English endorsement. You know, it makes it a lot easier to get a job if you can teach something else. And but his main ambition there was to be a coach and work with kids.
Now Collins also fit in in the Eastern Michigan University community at the time.
Yeah, and I can give you a little scenario about that, or synopsis, I should say. He did his first year of college at Central Michigan University in Mount Pleasant. His brother went there. His brother was, I think, 3 or 4 years older. And he lived with in his brother's house where he was renting. But that first year, he just didn't like it, didn't feel comfortable in Mount Pleasant. And so he wanted to get closer to home. And because he was pining for his high school girlfriend, who they had broken up, and he couldn't get over it. You know, a very common story. You know, the man just can't face the fact that she's not interested anymore, or, you know, doesn't feel comfortable with him. And so he got back closer by coming to Eastern Michigan, which was about 50 miles from his home in Centerline, a little bit north of Detroit. Centerline is kind of city within a city, I think, within Warren, Michigan.
Right.
And he would have, you know, he could ride with his motorcycle and in an hour or less be home. He tried to get back with his girlfriend once he got back to Ypsilanti. That had to be in 1966. And he asked her out on a date, and I talk about it in the book. And he says, do you think you could get back together again? And basically she said no. So I think he felt like he had the rejection of his mother on the one hand, and the rejection with the girlfriend on the other. And I don't think that he was emotionally, psychologically able to get over either one of those things. And I think he developed anger to a point of murder.
Well, now he was in a fraternity, I read someplace.
He was a Theta Chi, which was the Animal House fraternity on Eastern's campus. And there were a bunch of jocks who were dedicated to partying hardy, drinking a lot of alcohol. And bagging women. I'm trying to think of a better way to say it, but that's essentially what it was. And of course, when the new freshman class comes in, they hold these keggers and so on. And they draw a lot of, you know, young women to these. So there'd be a crowd, 300-400 people. They'd have to close the street. And so I think he saw that as a way to meet women.
Greg, this case drew more than a little attention in Michigan at the time, because I remember when I was a kid, this scared the hell out of a lot of people.
Well, this was good. And the reason I named the book the way I did, Terror in Ypsilanti, was because the fear was profound and widespread there more than anywhere. And I've had so many people who were children at the time remember their parents not letting them go out of the house, just being very protective, clamping down on them. And that leaves a big impression on a young kid.
Yeah. Now you would think that somebody who was, you know, becoming a household name within Southeastern Michigan would have been somebody whose dirty deeds, if you will, would have carried him into infamy for a long time, but his fame really was short-lived.
And, you know, I have a theory. I believe it's more than a theory on why. And it was because how his case was handled. And Neil Fink and Joseph Louisel, Detroit lawyers, were his lawyers. And Neil in particular was a very tenacious lawyer. And, you know, he'd object at the top of, you know, just something come up, bang, he'd be on it. So it was not a real smooth trial. But the real story for Collins not being better known has to go to the prosecutor in Washtenaw County. And he had, the year before, had a man who was a killer of two homosexual youths. And he lived in, his name was Ralph Nuss, and he lived in Ann Arbor, I think. And one of the kids he killed was, you know, kids 18, 19, 20. Years of age, was from Ipsy, and the other was from, of all places, Windsor, Ontario. And he was convicted of those murders. And then there was some kind of change in the Michigan court procedures or in the sentencing law. I'm not exactly certain what that circumstance was. You know, off the top of my head, I could find out. But and so Nuss, because of the changes in sentencing and so on, his lawyer got him off. And so Delhi, the prosecutor in Ann Arbor, wanted, you know, to put him back behind bars. He was still a dangerous man as far as he was concerned. And Nuss was able to walk on that. And part of the reason is that there was both of the murders were tried together. And so he didn't have a second case to fall back on. So by trying to go after Nuss again was double jeopardy, and he got out. Okay, now talking about Collins. When that case came out, the prosecutor remembered what had happened just a year previous, and he made the decision to only prosecute Collins for one of the murders. And I don't think he thought of the larger aspect of it, in that to be officially FBI certified, serial killer, you have to have three separate murders with a cooling off period, similar MOs, and there were four or five different categories, okay? So Collins was only tried for one of the cases, even though there were other very strong cases.
Were there six other victims?
There were six other victims, and one of them was from California. And that was a slam dunk case, which I talk about in the book, and it involves Governor Ronald Reagan and Governor William Milliken. And Milliken would not extradite Collins, even though there was a better case in California. And he would have gotten.
Did they have the death penalty then?
He would have gotten the death penalty if he had been convicted. But there's no question that the prosecutors out there had all the evidence they needed, physical and circumstantial evidence. So at any rate, two or three of the other Michigan murders, Delhi could have brought a case for them, but he wasn't aware of, you know, how history would, his decision would tend to cloak Collins in some anonymity, because he, if he had been a serial killer, other people would have written about him, and, you know, he would have been right with the the rest of the infamous serial killers.
When your book came out, I'm sorry, I talked over.
Excuse me.
When your book came out in 2016, it sort of stirred up the hornet's nest a little bit, and there became some interest in the DNA evidence that had been developed. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the Detroit Free Press, or might have been you, discovered that at least two DNA samples from two of the victims had never been tested. They had possession of it, but they didn't proceed to do testing for some reason.
Collins, to talk about that first, continually refused to give DNA until it was state law that all prisoners had to, you know, give saliva and or blood samples, whatever. But by the time they came around to DNA, one of the cases, a family brought the case with the DNA, and they brought the case, and somebody else was determined to have killed that victim, and it was assumed that Collins killed Jane Mixer. And DNA evidence in the 1980s, I believe it was, proved that the person who had murdered Mixer was someone else. So that's the one DNA aspect. Now, the other that I heard from Washtenaw County Sheriff Doug Harvey was that they found DNA on the hosiery of the next to the last victim. Her name was Alice Callum or Cologne. I'm not sure how to pronounce her name. And apparently she had been riding on the back of his motorcycle in a short skirt, and he had reached back and, you know, touched her on the thigh with, you know, sweaty hands. So he got epithelials on her pantyhose. But that was never, there was never a match.